I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour is the author of a really interesting piece in The Atlantic, The Most Important Takeover of Any Organization in History. He writes, Russell Berman, that is, on Tuesday, November 8, this 18-month marathon of a presidential race will finally end, and within hours, a new race will begin. This race will be much shorter, a 73-day sprint to hand over control of the entire federal government from one administration to the next, but it is no less daunting, and it hasn't been done very well on a lot of occasions. So there have been attempts for the past 8 years. Ex-government officials, good governance advocates, and lawmakers in Congress have been working to improve presidential transition so that people aren't trying to hire everybody at the last minute and so they understand what some of the issues are taking place in terms of national security, in terms of the economic situation, so you don't have people getting up to speed and getting all their staffs in place, until maybe a year later. And we'll look at Senate confirmation of all of these people and more. So that's what we're talking about this hour of the program. It should be an interesting hour. We have two guests with us. Russell Berman is senior associate editor at The Atlantic, where he covers political news. He was previously a congressional reporter for The Hill and a Washington correspondent for The New York Sun. Russell, thank you very much for being with us.
Good to be with you.
And also joining us is Max Steyer. Max is president and CEO of the Partnership for Public Service. It is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization dedicated to revitalizing our federal government by inspiring a new generation to serve and transforming the way that government works. Max, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So until maybe recently, and now we have some new laws and people studying this, but it sounds, Russell, historically, that this was kind of a willy-nilly, hodgepodge transition that took place where so much more should have been planned, and it simply wasn't. Why did we let it go for so long?
That's right. I was really surprised to learn that it's been such an ad hoc operation in the past. It doesn't take very long. It's only a couple months between the election and the inauguration. And, you know, it's basically the candidates have gotten, national security briefings, but very little of it has started in the past before the election. And then, you often have the awkward tension of one party taking over for another. And so it's in a very compressed time frame, and there just hasn't been a playbook for doing it, and that's what they're trying to do for this election and what they've been trying to do really for the last 8 years or so.
Mm-hmm. And in some cases, there are major things going on. There's an economic crisis that's about to become full-fledged, or there's a huge national security crisis.
Right. I mean, the experts point out that there's no time where the United States is more vulnerable than in this transition period. And yet you have the government that's not fully staffed. You have a lot of people who have left the previous administration mm-hmm. early, and then you don't have, because of the Senate confirmation process, you don't have anybody really coming in right away except for the top people, the cabinet officers. And so, for example, in 2009, you mentioned the economic crisis. Timothy Geithner, the Treasury Secretary, was virtually working alone in the Treasury Department to respond to that. In terms of the political appointees who really make the hard decisions in every department. And that was the case across the government when they were, the president scored a big victory by passing the economic stimulus package early in February of 2009, and yet all of the departments that were charged with spending that money, to get those shovel-ready jobs, if you remember, they were all empty, just as empty as the Treasury Department. And so it really limits the ability of the government to deliver on the new president's promises in, what everybody considers the most important period of any president's tenure, which is that honeymoon.
Right. So, Max, I'm wondering, it's kind of a tricky thing here, isn't it? Because we don't elect until November, and then we have a swearing-in in January. It sounds like this process needs more than that time period, but what do you do when you don't know who's going to be elected?
Well, it is a real challenge, and I think the reason why this has not been more front and center in earlier cycles is that the risk is now more apparent that sloppy handoffs are now something that might involve, as you've already suggested, an economic crisis, or certainly in the world we live in today, a human-made one, and the risk of a terrorist act at the point of maximum vulnerability is quite high. So I think the point here is that whether or not you have a president-elect, each and every candidate who believes that they have any realistic chance of becoming president owes it to the American people to begin preparing to follow through on the promises that they're making and begin preparing to take over the government. That clearly, you know, only one of those candidates ultimately wins, but all of them, just as all of them are campaigning, need to dual track their activity, campaign to win, but prepare to actually run the government.
Mm. Is that happening now among the candidates, Russell?
You know, it is. Max can actually tell you a little bit more, but they apparently sent representatives to a conference that the Partnership for Public Service holds every 4 years. But if they're doing much, they're being very quiet about it. They haven't announced publicly, you know, who would lead their transitions. They're obviously focused more on securing the nominations.
Sure.
And I think that the long nomination battle in each party, which has gone on longer this year than in past years, you know, has hampered probably their ability to start thinking seriously about it, at least in a public way, because of that concern of, you know, being seen as measuring the drapes.
Right.
And certainly that's going to be a big issue, certainly in the primary, maybe less so once they get past and into the general election.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that must be hard for those who are involved in the planning, Max, because they might be planning for something that's not going to happen. That's a letdown.
Yeah, I think that's the nature of the beast, though. Everyone who's involved in a campaign understands that they run the risk of ultimately not running, and they have to understand that they also need to run the risk of preparing to govern and not having that opportunity either. I think there really is a, you know, fundamental culture shift that we're seeing started but not completed yet, and that is that you can't do these things sequentially. You actually have to do them consecutively if you're being responsible in today's day and age. And there will always be something when you're campaigning that is drawing your attention away from thinking about what happens next, but you don't want to be left in the position that Robert Redford was in The Graduate of asking that question, now what?
Right.
Nor should the American people be left in that position, particularly in the world that we live in today. And so I think fundamentally it really begins with the media and with the public demanding that candidates actually, you know, put their money where their mouth is, and they're making promises. If they're making promises, they have to demonstrate that they can follow through on them. And in order to do that, they really need to begin now in planning for a takeover of the government, whether or not that means that they actually get to see that investment carry out. It's the right and responsible thing to do. And it is true that, you know, that it's easier if you think about it in the context of two candidates rather than five candidates. But at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter. No candidate will ultimately be ready to hit the ground running on day one if they don't start today. And starting today means, at the beginning, identifying their leadership team, who are going to be different from the campaign people, because there's no way you can actually be campaigning and putting together the transition at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
But they need to get that infrastructure put in place today. If they're elected president, they're not going to be living in a world that throws one problem at a time at them. They can't deal with North Korea and at one time and Russia another. You might get both at the same day. And same with the candidates. They got to demonstrate that they can campaign and also prepare to govern at the same time.
Right. I think, Russell, you mentioned, and this is a large number of people, I'm wondering when they get appointed, that there are more than 4,000 political appointees in the federal government. So all of those people are to be appointed during a, what, 73-day period of time? Or is there a way to start thinking about filling those so that they can get in their work situations sooner than that? And also, how many of those need Senate confirmation, and what rules have changed in that regard?
Right. So, you know, even under the most optimistic scenario, you're not going to fill all 4,000 of those positions in the period between the election and the inauguration. But what, you know, Max and everybody else is trying to push is for them to set their goals higher, so that instead of just getting a few dozen people, which is what they've done in the past, appointed and confirmed and or confirmed, they can start getting a couple of hundred people, and then by the first several months of the administration, they can get several hundred more people confirmed, and at least that would be a big improvement over the past years. And one way to do that, that they've started doing, and they started doing actually in 2008 and in 2012, is as the election gets closer, the outgoing administration will provide and allow for the campaigns to send them names of the people that they think will comprise their national security teams so that they can start to get national security clearances and be ready to essentially sort of take over right after the election, or at least be able to be briefed on everything by the outgoing administration, and then they'd be ready to start their jobs on January 20th. Mm. And so the national security clearance portion of that has been a big hurdle, and it's one of the areas where they've actually seen a lot of improvement over the last several years. And you mentioned, of course, the Senate confirmation process. That's a whole other issue. It's, of course, more lengthy and intensive and scrutinizing than ever before. And so what they've done is they did pass a law that reduced the number of positions that are subject to Senate confirmation. So that'll make it a little bit easier for the new president to get his or her team in place, because not so many of those people will have to go into the logjam that we know.
Yeah.
It's just to underscore what Russell said, there's still 1,000 positions that are Senate confirmed.
Wow.
And of those 4,000, really about 400 to 500 are sort of the core top positions that you really need to fill in order to have a full team running the government. Russell has done, I will say, a exceptional job at outlining the nature of the problem and some of the history. And hats off to you, Russell, on the just terrific piece you did.
Yeah, it is. It's very good. It makes us aware of something we should be more than aware of. Have there been any other? Tell us more about the bills that have been passed that changed things so that we couldn't face a catastrophe. Have we passed all that we need to pass to make sure there's a peaceful, successful transition?
Not yet. This is Max, and the answer is there are three pieces of legislation in recent times that got passed. The first was actually passed in 2010, and Senator Ted Kaufman was the main sponsor of that. And the important aspect of that legislation moved the date of support for transition planning from the election to the convention. And the intent there was to deal with a fundamental hurdle that every campaign had, and that's the one that Russell mentioned, which was pre-election transition planning was seen as a political vulnerability and undermining job number one, which was to get elected. To work on transition planning in any consequential way put you at risk of being accused of threatening measuring the drapes, and candidates didn't want to do that. So by moving the date of support to the convention, or 3 days after the convention, what that meant is now you have a congressional mandate that says, in fact, you ought to be preparing pre-election for the instance that you are actually elected. So that was the first piece. The second one has already been alluded to, and that is reducing the number of Senate-confirmed positions. And that got passed in 2012. And then the last piece got passed about a month ago, and it really requires the outgoing administration to do a number of smart things to make sure the handoff to the new folks coming in is done in a much more orderly fashion, because really there was almost no required process associated with it up until now. So the back end of your question was, what more to come? And there is definitely more to do. I mentioned that there's still 1,000 Senate-confirmed positions. That's way too many. Indeed, there are 4,000 still political appointees, and that's still too many. It's really still a spoil system. Mm-hmm. The one thing that would be enormously helpful was actually getting that number down to a reasonable size so that you actually don't have so many people going through a crazy process. You could also, frankly, improve the process itself, which would be a huge benefit as well. And there are other things that would matter, but those would be the two that would be most meaningful.
Mm-hmm. Russell, let's talk about some. I keep having this picture of Timothy Geithner sitting by all by himself as the economy is about to collapse and nobody even to talk to about it, which is quite an image. But let's look at some other things that are highlights from your article, and let's talk more about this Bush chief of staff, Joshua Bolten, getting a call from his predecessor in the Clinton White House on September 11th, 2001. What was that call?
Yeah, that was fascinating. He told me that, remember, this is 8 months, of course, after they've taken over. He's sitting at his desk. The phone that rings is from the inside lines. This is not you know, the receptionist who directs most of his calls, he said that even he didn't really know the number.
Oh.
And so it was Steve Ricchetti, who held his job in the latter days of the Clinton administration, who sat at that desk, called his direct line, and said, "Do you know about the bunker?" Referring to the now famous command center under the White House, where President Bush would ultimately, you know, convene his national security team in the hours and days and weeks after the attacks. And they did know about the bunker because another veteran of previous administrations, Joe Hagan, had done a tour for the senior staff earlier in the Bush administration soon after they came in. But just the very fact that Steve Ricchetti thought that it was possible that 8 months into the administration that they wouldn't know about it really shows you how little institutional planning is done. So, of course, it worked out in that sense, but, you know, that could have been another sort of adding to that disaster.
Yeah. The people who seemed to do a good job, and maybe it was because of the phone call that came in on September 11th of 2001, the Bush administration handoff to the Obama administration, even the Obama administration gave the Bush administration really high praise for that handoff, didn't they?
They did. You know, we often hear, and we did hear the president, President Obama, as a senator, criticize anything and everything having to do with his predecessor. But they are very praising of how they handled it in 2008. President Bush, about a year or so before the end of his administration, convened his top staff, talked to Josh Bolton, his chief of staff, and said, "I want this to be the best transition ever, because this is the first time, really, that we've been in a war footing when we've in a post 9/11 world where we've had to transfer the federal government." And so that message went out across the government, and they did do a good job of making sure both the Obama and the McCain campaigns had the opportunity to submit names, as I was mentioning earlier, of people who could get security clearances, and doing other things like, you know, just even asking them, you know, we are shifting over the presidential personnel software program in the White House. You guys are going to be using it, so what do you want us to, you know, what do you want us to do? How do you want that to look?
Mm-hmm.
You know, things like that that are somewhat mundane but very important to the working of the government. They did that. And so it was a successful transfer on the front end, although, as I go into in the piece, after the first phase of getting into office, it seemed that the Obama administration did sort of slow down or drop the ball when it came to filling those positions below the cabinet level, so that people like Tim Geithner were, you know, would have had more company in the cabinet departments, so that they could sort of get off to a faster
right.
start.
Max, you were quoted in the article as saying that no one has really done this right. It's a process that has been done incrementally better over time, but we're in a world of risk that requires a gigantic step up in the way we hand over the reins of power. Is it an early model to look at the way the Bush administration handed over the reins to the Obama administration?
So, absolutely. And there's really two parts to this, right? So there are the folks that are leaving and the folks that are coming in, and certainly the Bush administration did the best that's ever been done on the handoff to the Obama team. That said, I think, you know, you always can do better, and there are opportunities to do so even in that aspect. But where I think the biggest opportunity for improvement comes is from the incoming team. And part of it is, we talked earlier about the need for earlier planning. And if you only have 73 or 77 days, depending on the time between the election and inauguration, that's never going to be enough. You can start a lot early, and candidates need to do that if they're going to actually be ready to do all that needs to happen. You mentioned the 4,000 political appointees. That's a big piece of it. The pacing has never been right. So one of our propositions is that campaigns or transition teams have not actually started with the right goals in mind. And if you don't start with the right goals, you don't get the right things done. On the personnel side, our proposition is that you ought to be able to shoot for having your full critical leadership team in place no later than after your first 200 days or by the August recess. And you ought to have your top 100 Senate-confirmed positions in at the very front end. And Russell mentioned for the Obama team that they bluntly set the wrong goal at the front end. They had about 34 people on their initial list of who they wanted to get confirmed. And our proposition would be it should be almost triple that number if you were really doing it right.
Ooh.
That requires you to, you know, prepare differently. It requires you to think about this as a team rather than a single individual. So the Obama folks wanted to get their cabinet secretaries in, and our proposition is that you ought to try to get your top folks in, including the number two, so you don't have a Tim Geithner home alone. And it means thinking about what happens after that first wave, which, again, Russell chronicles was didn't work out real well for the Obama folks.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's welcome phone calls. Our guests are either quoted in extensively and involved in making the transition team larger and more successful as we go from one administration to another. Russell Berman is the author of a new feature in The Atlantic, which is titled The Most Important Takeover of Any Organization in History. And it looks at, you know, this is forever presidential race, but a very short period of time to hand over control of the entire federal government. And although we're getting a wee bit better at how we do this, we're still a far cry from how it should be done when you're considering matters of national security and big issues that need to be dealt with by offices that are staffed with people who know what they're doing. So our guests this hour are the author of the piece in The Atlantic, Russell Berman, senior associate editor at The Atlantic. He covers political news. And Max Steyer is president and CEO of the Partnership for Public Service, which is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization dedicated to revitalizing our federal government by inspiring a new generation to serve and by transforming the way that government works. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. We have lines open for you right now. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. Our Facebook page, where we enjoy reading your thoughts, is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's welcome phone calls for our guests, and we referenced the piece, and it's on our Facebook page if you would like to read it. The Most Important Takeover of Any Organization in History. We start our calls with Chris in Wisconsin Dells. Hi, Chris.
Hi, I was involved. Can you hear me? Because I'm
yes,
having
we're
telephone.
Fine. Yeah, you're
okay.
Fine.
Okay, I'm having telephone issues. I was involved in a major U.S. Department of Labor investigation, and the Justice Department got called in. And it was right at the George Bush into the Clinton administration. If you can recall this, Bill Clinton couldn't get anybody through this.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Chris. Your phone, I can't hear you. Every other word is now going out, so you'll have to call us back on another phone. Jimmy in Valley Junction. Hi, Jimmy.
Afternoon,
Jimmy.
Say, I guess my point would be, why in the world are there that many appointed positions in the federal government, and wouldn't we be better served by having tenured federal employees who are hopefully above the political issues that go on between administrations in place, so there would be a more smooth transition instead of all this upheaval? And I will take my answer off the air.
All right, Max, that goes to you.
Yeah, you know, I couldn't say that better. You're absolutely right. There are too many, and if you look across the developed world, there's not a democracy that I'm aware of that has anywhere close to the number of appointees that we have. I do think it's still too much of a spoil system. It makes a lot of sense for a president to be able to come in with his or her team of some size, but 4,000 is overkill. And it creates all kind of dysfunction, not only at the very front end, but also later on when you have career civil servants that bump up against a glass ceiling in terms of their ability to move up, and the political appointees themselves believe they can recreate a command and control system with the political appointees and fail to recognize that they actually need to engage the career workforce to succeed. So I agree with your point 100%. One long-term solution here is reduce the number of political appointees total, and I think you would have a better government.
Mm. We've talked about the Bush to the Obama handoff. What about other handoffs, Russell? Let's say the first George Herbert Walker Bush handoff to the Clintons, the Clinton handoff to the Bushes.
Right. Those were, you know, I talked to Josh Bolton. He was involved in a number of handoffs, and he was in the White House at the end of the first Bush administration, and he remembers walking around the West Wing you know, at the January 19th, the day before, and it was just a construction zone, and there was computers on the desks, but the hard drives had been replaced. And he said it was like walking into onto a blank playing field, imagining the Clinton team coming in the next day. And I talked to Mac McLarty, and he didn't make it into the article, but he was the first chief of staff for President Clinton. And he said, you know, the Bush people, once they realized they lost in 1992, they were very helpful, but there wasn't much of a formal transition process in place. And Bolton said that 8 years later, there hadn't been much improvement over the course of the Clinton administration in terms of the transition from Clinton back to the second President Bush. And, of course, that transition was abbreviated because we didn't know who the president would be for
right.
a month after the election.
Right.
So that was a unique and even more difficult time.
Yeah. So is it true they took the W's off the computers?
Yes, but it's just interesting that got all the attention.
Yes,
and
it did.
There's probably much more important and impactful consequences of poor transition planning than just sort of pranks. Not to totally belittle what was done there. They were, I think, investigated as a crime, but there are probably bigger fish to fry.
Right. So give us a picture of what it looks like. If you're going into the West Wing, if you're going into the White House, everything is off the walls? Everything's out of the bookcases?
Well, I don't know if that's what happens now, but that's what Josh Bolton said was the case in 1992, where it's, you know, because each, not only is a new workforce coming in, but a new family is coming in to live in the building. And so they have, they can basically design it to a certain extent as they want. And so he said there was a lot of work being done just based on their requests of the incoming Clinton team as to how they wanted the White House to look.
Mm-hmm.
But generally speaking, there's not a shred of paper, and there's certainly not an electronic file that's left in the White House. So you are really coming into a blank slate, leave alone the physical surroundings. You really are starting afresh at the White House. And the agencies, it's a different proposition. And there, it's almost the reverse problem, which is you have way, way too much information that's collected, binderfuls and binderfuls of stuff that is not actually useful, because it often isn't about the things that the new folks actually need to know, and it's more than anybody could possibly absorb. But this is part of the issue here. This is a process, again, the most important takeover of any organization in history, that has largely been done, again, as a Groundhog Day phenomenon, built from scratch each and every time. There's been no institutional history. There's been no learning system associated with it. And by and large, it's been done really poorly. And I think, you know, what you're seeing now, I think, very importantly, is an effort to create that learning system and better practice, because the risk side of the equation is so fundamentally scary.
Right. I want to talk to you a little bit more, Max, about inspiring a new generation to serve and transform the way government works. Are we having problems inspiring a new generation? Are we finding a lot of older people who are taking these federal positions and this new talent doesn't want to go into government service?
Well, it's a complicated mess, to be honest with you.
Is it?
Yes. So if you look at the demographics, under 7% of the federal workforce is under the age of 30, and under 1% is under the age of 25. And the interesting problem, though, is that there are, in fact, a lot of young people interested in coming into government, but the government isn't really good about bringing in the people it actually needs. So you have a hiring process that is predisposed to take people with prior experience rather than phenomenal capacity. So it's certainly true that we would benefit from more people, not just young people, being interested in government service and seeing it as public service. But the reality is that our government today doesn't take advantage of the talent that it already has available to it. You layer on top of that what I think is almost a more fundamental problem, and that is that the American public is becoming increasingly distrustful and dangerously distrustful of its government. And I think that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Public doesn't believe government can actually deliver on its promises. It doesn't look to support government in the ways that it needs to in order for government to be healthy. And that's the downward spiral that I think we're in today. And plainly, the political conversation, which often gets mixed up with the actual mechanics and career workforce, makes things even worse.
Yeah. Russell, let's look at that calendar again. We're having this campaign election cycle that goes longer and longer, it seems, every year, and then this short 73 days to make the transition happen. Do we have our calendars mixed up? Do you think that we need more time? Maybe we should have it the way that we used to have it. That the when did the inauguration used to be? It wasn't in January always, was it?
Right. It was in April for much of the country's history, if I'm not mistaken.
Do you think we should do that again?
Well, that would create a whole different set of issues in terms of you would have a much longer lame duck period for
right.
the administration, and then you'd have the question of, you know, they'd have to make more and more key decisions even though they were about to head out the door. And then, you know, in other countries, the election period is actually much shorter. You know, in Britain, they only have elections that last, what, six weeks or a couple months. It's impossible to do a transition that's probably longer than the election in that sense. So I'm not sure, if lengthening the transition would really help. But I would be interested to hear what Max thinks about that.
What do you think, Max?
Well, I think Russell got it right, and that is that you have a real problem by extending the period from election to inauguration. One of the things that's already happening is as the transition process gets more complete, as it should, the preparation for it, you wind up with people wanting to know what's going on inside government who want to actually run the government, and they really can't. I mean, we have one president at a time, and so it's not until inauguration that the actual formal handoff occurs. I think the solution is not trying to extend the period of inauguration, but rather extend the period on the front end in which candidates are actually preparing. And if they do that, they can actually be ready to govern without the kind of conflict that's been identified here. One other point to note, and that is that our challenges in this country are created not only by the fact that we have such a large number of political appointees, but, you know, unlike a lot of other countries, we have, you know, separation of powers. So you have a legislative and executive power that's, you know, separate. So in other countries where you see a much quicker handoff, you in essence have people that have been a government in waiting, who have been serving in parliament as the shadow minister, and therefore are typically much more up to speed onto what has to happen in order to run the government as they would like to see it happen. So the processes are quite a bit different. But I think this is doable. This is one of these things where we live in a world of a lot of different problems. Making this work a ton better, if not right, is actually doable. And it really involves just good management. And it starts with campaigns recognizing that they ought to be able to, you know, walk and chew gum at the same time, and that the public has to expect them to do that. And that means that you create a transition structure that's going side by side with your campaign structure. It's run by someone trusted by the candidate and trusted by the campaign, you know, senior management, but they are doing the things that are necessary if and when their candidate actually wins.
Mm. After doing work on the story, Russell, do you agree with Max that it is doable?
Yes, and one key element there is that we almost got to see it in 2012. Mitt Romney did put a ton of effort into transition planning. He named a former health secretary and former Utah Governor Mike Leavitt to lead it early on. He, of course, won the primary fairly early in the process, so he had more time as the presumptive nominee. But Leavitt told me that by Election Day, they had 600 people staffed in a transition office set up by the General Services Administration of the federal government, waiting to sort of move in if Romney had won the election. And,
goodness.
And as he said, you know, they built a ship. It just didn't sail because he lost the election. So we were only able to see the front end of that and not actually how it worked out in coordination with the outgoing administration.
Wow, that's a lot of people. What did how are you going to find capable people who were going to work for a few months and then maybe lose their jobs?
And it was interesting that he said that one of the requirements, essentially, of people who wanted to work on the transition was that there was no guarantee of a position in the new Romney administration. But part of it, a big part of it, was time. I mean, they started in, I think, April or May of, you know, the election year. And so they had 4 or 5 months to get staffed up. And they had a whole list of the promises and the detailed campaign plans that Romney had put out. They weren't doing any policy, but they were essentially saying, here's what Romney has promised to do, and let's try and see and figure out how we can get him ready to do that if he wins.
Mm. Max, you were going to say something.
No, I think, again, this is exactly right. I mean, it's a phenomenally complicated task, so, you know, 600 people is actually not that many given what needs to be done. You think about the campaign architectures are larger than that. You know, you have multiple aspects of this. You have the personnel side that we've discussed. You got to figure out, you know, who are the right people for these positions, and you
right.
have to begin the vetting process of them. You have the campaign promise implementation aspect of this. You have the understanding of the, you know, 100-plus different agencies, and then each of those divided into sub-pieces. So you have what are called landing teams or parachute teams that go into them to understand what's occurring in those places. You have the, you know, the operation of the president-elect and the vice president-elect. You know, what are they going to do in terms of their schedule? Who are they going to meet? How are they going to be taken care of? It's a very, very, very complicated and large operation.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about a, you know, a $3-plus trillion organization with, you know, 4 million people if you count the armed services and the postal service. And so it's a daunting task and one that no one does real well, and we all suffer at a consequence of that.
All right, we're going to try Chris again in Wisconsin Dells. Hi, Chris.
Hi, I have resolved my technology problem, I think.
Okay.
I was involved in a major U.S. Department of Labor investigation that almost shut down a state agency. And the Justice Department was called in. And this was right at the beginning of the Clinton administration. It went from the George Bush administration to the Clinton administration. And everything just got put on hold. And I was talking to the lawyer in Washington, D.C., and I said, how come nothing is happening? And he said, I don't even know if I'm going to have a job next month.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, nothing is being transferred to anybody. Everything is just on hold. Well, the whole thing, if you recall, Bill Clinton couldn't get anybody through the Senate for like almost a year, I think, in terms of the Attorney General and the other people involved in the Justice Department that had to be confirmed. And so everything just got put on hold. And people like me who are just a little citizen, there are time limits on how long this stuff can sit in the federal agency before somebody is just going to shut it down. They shut down my Justice Department investigation.
Yeah. Max?
Well, I think... Again, the problems are substantial, you know, when you don't have leadership in place. And it's true that the jobs are, the folks that are in those positions are serving at the pleasure of the president. They don't actually, you know, many of them leave well before the actual inauguration because they are thinking about what's happening to them next. So there are a lot of things that stop in government. We talked a little bit about the last piece of legislation that got passed that was signed by President Obama essentially a month ago. One of its provisions actually requires that the outgoing administration identify a career person to serve in an acting role for every critical political position that exists. So again, this is all about good governance. It also requires that every agency identify a top career person to help manage the transition process 6 months before the election and that a council of all those folks be created. So I think we live in a world in which there have been substantial improvements. We still have a ways to go, and the law is the starting pistol. Now we have to operationalize it in an effective way.
Dan in Boulder Junction, hi.
Good afternoon. I'm wondering why, if we're in the process of electing the president of the whole country, why isn't it the federal government who sets all the rules? For example, for the duration of the nomination process, for the procedure in electing electors, for superdelegates if they have any need, it's abundantly clear to the public now that we are allowed to vote for the candidates chosen by the party hacks.
All right, Dan, this is a little bit off topic, but Russell, I'm sure you have thoughts on it.
Well, I think it would be problematic to have the government controlling the aspect of the election of the government to replace it because, you know, the government is, you know, a democratic government right now. Would you trust the Obama administration to set the rules for the Republican nomination process, for example? That's just one example. Although a related point, though, is in this entire discussion, you know, the laws that have been passed put requirements on the outgoing administration to provide help to the campaigns, but it doesn't require the campaigns to actually participate. It doesn't require the candidates to do this planning. And so that's an aspect that we're going to see very, very soon as we go along, which candidates are actually taking this seriously. Obviously, we have one very unconventional candidate in Donald Trump. He's railed against the incompetent Obama administration, and, you know, would he even take the help of the Obama administration in trying to set up a government in waiting if he were the Republican nominee? And so that's a big question that I have, at least, going forward in this process.
More phone calls in a moment. Dan, thanks for yours. We're talking this hour about a piece that is in the Atlantic, the most important takeover of any organization in history. It looks at the long presidential election and then what happens and what needs to happen between the election and the inauguration to prepare for a successful transition, to get people in place so that they can handle the affairs of state. And there are many of them, and many of them are incredibly important. And it sounds from the article and from both of our guest comments that we're doing a little bit better job, but we could do a whole lot better. Our guests are Russell Berman, Senior Associate Editor at The Atlantic. He covers political news. Max Steyer, President and CEO of the Partnership for Public Service, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that works to revitalize our federal government by inspiring a new generation to serve and also by transforming the way that government works. Phone lines are open if you'd like to join the conversation. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we are on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we welcome you to join us in the last minutes of our show here as we talk about the transition of the federal government. 800-486-8655 is the number. I had a question about when you would start. You look at the Republican field, if some of those people hadn't dropped out, you would have had a massive number of people perhaps still in the running. At what point do you say, all right, this is the cutoff date, now you have to prepare the transition? Do you wait till it gets down to two? Do you wait till it gets to three? What do you do?
I think it depends what your goal is. If you want to be ready, it doesn't matter how many candidates there are. You got to start when you need to start. And realistically, that's right now. If you're not moving aggressively today, you're just not going to be ready. So I mentioned the law that moves the date of support from election day to the convention. We have a convention that is now at least, you know, almost 6 weeks earlier than it was 4 years ago. Russell mentioned how well the Romney team was prepared. They had begun essentially by the beginning of May. So if you think about, 6 weeks earlier, you're already, you know, late to the party if you haven't started working on it.
Mm-hmm. Russell, there are other things that you mentioned in the article that I wanted to talk about and how important it is to have plans in place. Take us back to Inauguration Day of 2009 when officials received word of a credible plot to strike the National Mall.
Right. And this was Josh Bolton told me about how on Inauguration Day you have the sort of ceremonial coffee that the outgoing president hosts for the incoming president and his family or his wife. And they're in that coffee, the chiefs of staff are. And Bolton, you know, takes Rahm Emanuel, the incoming chief of staff, out of the room. They go down to the Situation Room, and they, you know, prepare to respond to this possible terrorist attack, you know, just a couple hours before Obama was to be inaugurated. And they had, you know, meetings, and they talked about, well, if there's a bomb that goes off on the mall, will Obama stop his address and things like that. And, you know, Bolton said this was a result of the fact that they did do planning and they did bring in the entire incoming Obama national security team for an exercise beforehand. And so he said, imagine if that happened without any planning. And, of course, everything turned out okay. But, you know, that's an example of the threat that is possible during this period of transition.
Mm-hmm. And, Max, I'm wondering about everybody getting along with each other during these transition efforts. Heavens knows we're in incredibly partisan times, and people are downright nasty to each other, anything but being helpful in making a smooth transition. Does it become harder to have a smooth process when you have such animosity between the parties?
Not what I've seen so far.
Really?
So, yeah, I mean, it's quite exceptional. You know, let's go back to 2012 with the Romney folks. We brought them together with folks from the Obama White House to talk about transition planning in May of 2012. And, you know, as Russell mentioned, Mike Leavitt, former governor of Utah, and both, you know, cabinet secretary, head of EPA and of the Health and Human Services, led that effort. He had his two primary deputies and someone else, a very senior person from the Romney campaign, who took part. And the conversation was incredibly collaborative. And everyone in that room, including not only folks from the Obama White House, but, you know, folks that had, such as Josh Bolton, who had been involved in prior Republican administrations, everyone was incredibly helpful in trying to make sure that, you know, that if the Romney folks actually were going to govern, that they would be ready to do so. And that's what we've experienced so far as well in this cycle. You know, I think we are seeing the candidates who have engaged with us recognize that they're Americans first and candidates second, and they want to make sure that whoever our next president is going to actually be prepared to deal with the crises that are possible and the crises that we don't expect. And that, again, means, you know, working collectively to get this right.
Mm. So maybe there are some ways that this spirit of cooperation, Russell, from the transition teams could infuse other parts of government. Wouldn't that be nice?
It would. Part of the help, I think, is that all these things are done privately, so you don't have to worry about the public perception of, oh man, Romney and Obama are working together.
Right, right.
You know, Trump and Obama, if the case could be.
So take us back to 2008. You write about Obama quietly starting to work on a transition in May of 2008 before he was the nominee.
Right. He had deputized one of his top aides, Christopher Liu, to serve as the executive director of his transition team. And, of course, Liu wasn't even named officially that position until several months later after the election, but he had been working in that capacity beginning in May. And one of the interesting things that I sort of found out through talking to all these people is that even the Bush administration thought that Obama was more prepared to take over the government by the election of 2008 than John McCain, of course, who was the Republican nominee and more in line with the Bush administration. But McCain had more of the traditional superstitious attitude toward transition planning and didn't submit as many names and didn't take it, from my understanding, quite as seriously as Obama did. And so it would have been, they probably would have started off behind if McCain had won that election.
Hmm. And if you can, Max, give us an even more historical perspective on this. If you went way back in transition time, do we have any historical evidence that some were truly disastrous and some were better than others?
Well, one of the interesting aspects, and this comes back to the call you had earlier, is that transition planning, as our campaigns, are all private activities. So up until the creation of our Center on Presidential Transition, there really hasn't been any repository for information about prior transitions.
Oh.
If you were to look for this information, you'd have to dig through someone's attic or behind someone's desk to get it. So it's pretty crazy. And if you go to, you know, our website, which is, you know, now our hope is going to be the learning system going forward, just, you know, presidentialtransition.org, we've begun to collect. We've got, you know, Obama documents and Romney documents. But so the history becomes one of, you know, oral history, and that's what we got. If you go back, you look at the Clinton transition, I think many people would say that was one of the less well-done transitions, in part because they tried to staff the agencies before the White House, and the lesson learned from that was do the White House first because you can do those people very easily, and the agencies require the Senate to actually sign on. But the reality is that we're dealing with a much more complicated government than existed if you go back any distance of consequence. And so the requirements are much larger than they've ever been before.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, again, another reason why doing this more systematically, doing it earlier and doing it,
mm-hmm.
You know, is better is good for all of us.
Yeah. Thank you both so much. Interesting article and conversation. Max Steyer, thank you so much. And Russell Berman, thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing the hour and to Kendra Smith for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. Kendra is having her last day as an intern of our program. She's been just a delight to work with. Scotty and KP and I have really enjoyed her and we'll miss her. We'll miss her so much. I wish she could just stay with us. She's at the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater and is soon to get her master's, and we wish her well in this field of public radio or wherever she goes. Thanks to Kendra. And thanks to you, everybody, for listening. We'll be with you again tomorrow, and we hope you'll listen to us then. Thanks very much. This is the Ideas Network.